Well, I became more aware of the powers that are running this country and running all of us, right down to our local people. And going to Mississippi, and in the 70s, this was right after the harshest part of the civil rights, and everybody left because they said, well, we've got the law, it's okay now. But it wasn't. It was really, really sad. So we helped with an exchange program, a cultural exchange program with children. And when the students started to, the law students, or the one law student started to leave, Beulah Washington, a black leader in Grenada, Mississippi, said, Mel, we can't end this like this. This is the only time our children have had a good relationship with a white person. And we want that to continue. And so that was 45 years ago. Children from Mississippi stayed in white homes, mostly rural, in the state of Wisconsin. And after 3 or 4 years, it got so complicated, he turned it all over to me. And it was pretty rough because we never had enough money. We had to buy old school buses and paint them and get them legal. And we would transport as many as 10 round trips per summer. So, and during that time then, I got to know the parents and other people and sat through horrendous trials where innocent black people were framed and found guilty of crimes. In one case, a discrimination lawsuit from the federal farm programs. And we actually won a case, or they did, and got the right people from Washington, some that we knew and otherwise. And that was one of the first cases that black farmers ever won, and that's almost 40 years ago. Well, that helped me to see how broad the picture is of how agriculture and urban life and factory workers and everyone fit together, because all of these people are involved in all these programs. When the National Family Farm Coalition was formed in Omaha or someplace, or Kansas City, I can't remember, but friends of mine drove out of their way from northwestern Wisconsin to come over here and pick me up, and I know they were 4 hours out of their way both ways to make sure I went to this one of these organizing meetings, or maybe more than one. And of course, once I went, I was hooked, and that's how I got involved with National Family Farm Coalition. It evolved. There were big problems along the way. Chief executive officers and sometimes presidents of the organization were, I would say, corrupt. They were power hungry, and they had double agendas, and people were calling each other racists and so on at a meeting we went to in Washington. And so we just simply walked out, our Wisconsin delegation. So we had a meeting that evening in the basement of the hotel, 5 of us. But 15 people came. And so that's how we formed the Family Farm Defenders 15 years ago, whatever that is. We formed it to include at least 40% urban people, because we were finding our urban friends cared more about family farmers than farmers did and understood the reason for caring about them. They can look at it from a perspective and without all the garbage and propaganda that we as family farmers get. I get 4 farm papers, and only one of them I subscribe to. And the others are totally funded by the chemical companies, the fertilizer companies, and they need readership to justify the ads. Almost all the material is written by the transnational companies, the chemical companies. Of course, they're all intertwined with interlocking directorates and and all that. And most farmers don't understand that. So they're bombarded with that. And the same way with the farm programs that come out. They're funded the same way. They founded AFACT, which was founded by Monsanto. And they were part of it. But now they say it's a grassroots thing. Antibiotics are fed by the ton to cattle to make them grow faster and live in conditions of extreme overcrowding, and they won't get as sick. And if they get to a certain weight, they die because they're so hyped up. So you got to be sure and sell them before that. The urban people haven't got all that, and haven't had that message in front of them day and night. And so they can look at it objectively. I feel very sorry for these farmers who have nothing but that. And they're caught. And they're told you've got to expand. You've got to get bigger. You've got to use all this Roundup Ready. You've got to plant all these seeds. There's all kinds of problems they're finding now. Scientists are finding with cattle with abortions and a lot of reproductive problems with cattle and hogs that are fed these GMO crops. Over the years, after introduction of the first GMO to enter the food chain, before it happened, was the bovine growth hormone, which was being researched at the University of Wisconsin by American Cyanamid. We went to some of these early meetings of the scientists and from the university who were so excited about it. It's going to increase milk production 30%, which meant, and they said it, it put 30% more farmers off the land because of that much overproduction. And that wasn't the thing to tell farmers. So we listened to them, and there were a lot of flaws in what they were saying. And in the evening, it was more of a social area, as these scientists and researchers at the university started drinking and talking. They were making remarks about who could create the biggest monster because of their breakthrough. 50% of all the dairy products at that time, and that's 26 years ago, all the dairy products sold at the University of Wisconsin and the University Hospital, 50% of all the milk, the cottage cheese, the butter, everything that was manufactured in Madison at Babcock Hall and others, ice cream, came from these experimental cows. And no one knew about it except a small group of people. And they weren't even informed of it. Because we couldn't get any attention, I used my civil rights experience and wrote up a placard or a sign on a stick, and it said, "Do you know your guinea pigs?" And so on, and for this experiment. And I forget, and then I made out some crude, at the beginning, very crude information sheets, and I would go in front of the Memorial Union and hand out this information. Some of this went to Europe within a year, and the people in Germany and other countries were so excited to see the farmers marching on the university in opposition. A couple of times, like I was on a farm in Germany and staying overnight, and they said, "We were so excited when we saw the video of the farmers marching on the university." Well, I said, "Here I am." Those were all students milling around in front of the Memorial Union. They thought it was farmers marching on the university. They said, "Well, that's what inspired us to their consumer groups and farm groups to fight." And they still are keeping up the fights. These same people, many of them that I met in Europe on that first trip, were the founders of Via Campesina, the international peasant and worker group and family farm group that now represent about 400 million people around the world. And then out of that came the food sovereignty initiative. All of this has been real helpful to learn how all these tremendous farm methods, agriculture methods, and how you combat climate change, to be working with these people who risk their lives from coming from Indonesia, for instance, and coming from many countries that are oppressed. And of course, at these meetings, there are people from Iran, and there are people from Cuba, and there are people from Bolivia. We were in Mexico to talk to the people about resisting the CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, and we were in the state of Veracruz. And the other issue was Monsanto was offering them 500 pesos per hectare to plant GMO crops. And they hadn't even heard of those things. They were so far out. This would be 3 years ago. So that would have been, this is about 07 or 08. A young man gave an account of how he migrated the United States to work. And he had to, because of the loss of income there by NAFTA-related causes. And he, when he and his group came to the border of the U.S., the coyote who recruited them for, I think, $2,000 or $3,000, abandoned them because there was the border patrol. And so everybody ran, scattered in the desert. And he said, I never saw one of those people again. But he was able to find somehow a man from the U.S., an Anglo person, who did take him in and fed him and help him get further north away from the border. And now, after a year or maybe a little more in the U.S., he had to come back because of a death in the family. So we asked why, if he would go back again and face death and all this uncertainty. I have to, he said. And so later on, I talked to him through an interpreter, and he told me more of the story. And I was moved by it to hear it firsthand, because I'd read so many horror stories of what it's like for the migrants to cross the desert and be shot like rabbits, and they're not even counted, the bodies and the people that disappear. And so I took off my Via Campesina hat, my red cap here. It's MST, but it's the Landless Workers of Brazil. I have a number of those caps because I run into these people, a lot of international gatherings. And as I gave it to him, he pulled off this sombrero and gave it to me. So I hang this on my wall and wear it once in a while. The biggest dairy cooperative in the United States is DFA, Dairy Farmers of America. They are not a cooperative. They're using a cooperative legal rights, but they're corporate run. And they and Dean's Foods, well, they're also meshed, and they keep merging and so on. And foremost in Baraboo and Reedsburg, they are run by the same people. And the Kraft is one of the main players. And milk, the price of milk is set, Chicago Mercantile Exchange, on the price that they decide for that day is going to be the price of a 40-pound block of cheese, which amounts to maybe 2% of the milk in the United States. We've been dairy products short in the United States for 12 years. We're importing more than we're exporting. So whenever the price gets going up a little bit, they export or import a lot from India. Is one of the biggest ones. It's the biggest dairy producing country in the world. And we were importing from the Ukraine, Chernobyl region, of dry milk products. And countries we didn't think even had dairy cows. So every 17th of April, or close by, a working day, Family Farm Defenders organizes a protest in front of the CME in Chicago. And so 3 years ago, we got them to allow us to, some of us, three people, to go in and present what we wanted to their board. And so they dressed up and they went up. So the rest of us stayed outside in cow suits and otherwise and handed out leaflets. At first we drew huge amounts of police. They thought we were going to riot and burn some cars or something. And so that brought a lot of press, which is good. So we always alert the police before we go because we know people in Chicago that support it. And so that helps. And so anyway, these guys went up and the meeting started. They smiled benignly at these dumb farmers, that came to see them. And as time went on, and they said, well, we know that Kraft, and sometimes Kraft or sometimes DFA are the only bidders. So they bet how soon they can, under 5 minutes, set the price of cheese. And he said the smiles just disappeared off the faces. They knew their inside jokes. But that price then goes to Europe, the European Union, immediately. And from there, it goes all over the world. So we set the world price of milk is set in Chicago right now. And it could be whatever Kraft wants to make that quarter, or if DFA, or they collude. That influences our price. And it's always down because they want to make, they're so greedy, they want more and more profits. Kraft, I watch their quarterlies, and their biggest earnings are always when our price goes down. They decide, not only Kraft, but all these transnationals. When I'm overseas, I was in Brittany in March, France, an international interim meeting between the big Via Campesina meetings. And they talked of how there are transnational, they call them the TNCs, the transnational police. They have transnational police that are brutalizing these indigenous people and the poor people all over Africa and South America and Asia. And it's beginning to happen here in a different manner. In fact, they're criminalizing dissent of all kinds, any kind of dissent. And so far, it's happening here, but it's in a manner that it's a little hard to describe, but they're making it illegal to do a lot of things that we could do before, legally. All of those people understand because we work together, and I keep telling them it's the price is set at the CME. And now they understand that, and so they say we've got to all work together to curb the power of this TNCs. Because they are more powerful than many, many nations. And right now, they're as powerful as the U.S. But our local group now is sponsoring free meals, all local. And now all the meals have to be, that are done in the Lutheran Church in Reedsburg, have to be local. And so, and we started a farmer's market in Lion Ridge, which is on Wednesday. And we've, local hospitals, we're working with all of them. And the Sauk Prairie School is buying a lot of produce. They got a big grant to buy local, and they're just thrilled with it. Sweet corn by the truckload almost, because of the large school. And so there, all these opportunities are here, and we have to have this local to get around what's happening nationally and internationally. And that's what I've learned all over the world. There are such excellent models, just tremendous models, that I see in Africa and Asia and all over South America and Central America, and some in Canada too, that work. It's tremendous friendships and a sense of community. It's building, they said, that we're building community, these people all of a sudden say. We're building community. And that's the answer to a lot of what's the economic and social problems of